On this episode of Skeptico, Buddhist scholar and author Dr. Alan Wallace.
Is the Dalai Lama an atheist?
In the framing itself, the question is already skewed. It's not so obvious to a person who's totally immersed in Western civilization and has almost no glimmering of understanding of anything outside of Western civilization. And frankly, so much of the rhetoric, this anti-religious rhetoric from the likes of Richard Dawkins and so forth, is just wildly, unconsciously, and uncritically ethnocentric. Do the Buddhists themselves, and I'm honing in on your question, do the Buddhists themselves ask, are we atheists? Well, I've never seen that question both in Buddhism. It would be regarded as such a dumb and uninformed question that it's not even worthy of a response.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on today's episode, well, we have a lot to cover, and we have a very interesting interview coming up, but before we get to that, I wanted to bring you up to date on the Medium experiment, because I know a lot of you are interested in that and have done a fantastic job of following it, giving us feedback, both positive and negative, skeptics and believers, if you will, and I wanted to bring you up to date on where we are. So, as most of you know, we've been doing this Medium experiment over the last couple months where we asked people who wanted to connect with their loved ones to fill out an online survey and record a short message. And then we went out and asked several mediums to do a reading for that person. And in doing this, we've collaborated with skeptical folks, folks from the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, skeptics who listen to this show, and we tried to design an experiment that takes into account the skeptical view of medium readings. So we've been doing this. It's been very, very interesting, very preliminary at the same time. We've been poking around, trying to find out what works. We've had some successes, if you will, in the first two trials, especially the second trial that showed some kind of interesting results. But then we did the third trial, and it really threw me for a loop. And it caused me to rethink a lot of aspects of this experiment. So with that in mind, I want to take some time today and a step back and tell you where we've been and where we're going. So let me start with the big picture stuff, my biggest takeaways thus far. And then I can tell you a little bit about where we're going. So the first big takeaway for me from the Medium experiment is that there's definitely something going on here, and it's absolutely just criminal that more researchers aren't investigating this. At this point, I've had a chance to work with dozens and dozens of mediums, probably 30 or 40, and have been involved with, well over 100 readings. I don't even know exactly how many. And from all those, I can tell you, the information that I've seen come through is nothing short than amazing. I mean, they're not always right, the mediums aren't, but they're way, way above chance levels. And that's just a gut feel without any putting any statistics on it. But it's my big takeaway from this is there's definitely something going on. And I feel so strongly about that because every once in a while you get these dazzlingly accurate, out-of-the-blue insights that are impossible to explain by conventional means. So the big takeaway, there's something going on here. The second big takeaway is that experimentation in this field is not that hard, really. I mean, this stuff is doable. And the basic format that we've started up here, where mediums listen to a brief recording and then answer multiple choice questions, it's seeming like it's a pretty good way to go about this. So this is all doable. But it's also tricky in some very subtle ways that we're continuing to find out. Let's start from the beginning. You remember when I first started this experiment, I was really emphatic about saying that this is about anomalous cognition and that we shouldn't ask the question, is this mediumship versus remote viewing, psi versus super psi or telepathy or any of those things until we just establish the basic fact that anomalous cognition is somehow going on here. And I still hold by that. I think that's correct. But what I didn't see is the second half of that equation, the cold reading part. Now, recall that cold reading means using ordinary logic and deduction to give the appearance of psychic abilities. But let me explain how that's relevant to this experiment, how it factors in. You may recall that on a couple episodes back in Skeptico, we heard from Dr. Steve Novella, and his conclusion on the experiment was that even if we achieved success, we wouldn't really be showing anything other than whether mediums are better cold readers than the rest of us. Now, while I don't think Steve had that quite right, he did touch on a point that I'm coming to understand is more and more important, and that's that you can't do an experiment like this, an experiment where you're asking two groups to do multiple choice questions. You can't do that and then draw too many conclusions about the overall results of the one group, the mediums, versus the other group, the skeptics. And you can't do that because, as Steve was alluding to, some folks are just better cold readers than others. Now, I'm not sure that mediums fall into that category, but let's set that aside for a minute and deal with the fact that some folks are better at cold reading than others. We've definitely proven that in this experiment. So that means two things. One, you really have to find your best cold readers and really study them. And number two, you really have to study what they're coming up with. Like the example I gave you last time, where a cold reader in trial two concluded that since the sitter had an Australian accent, they'd be less likely to be a murder victim. That's good stuff. And it points out just how much some people can do with just a very little amount of information. So really taking into account the cold reader aspect of this experiment has caused me to come to a different understanding of what this experiment is all about. So here's how I'd reframe the central question of this experiment based on what we've learned. And that's this. Can cold reading techniques explain the apparent anomalous cognition that mediums demonstrate? See, I don't think you can just ask if mediums can demonstrate anomalous cognition, because then you have folks like Steve saying, yeah, but they're just really good at cold reading. What I really need to do is ask, if I know that some people are really good at picking up these little clues from the sound of a person's voice and their name, then let's see how far they can go with that information. And then let's see if mediums can do better. Because really, that is the prevailing view among science at this standpoint. I mean, the prevailing view is that mediums are just using cold reading techniques. So what you have to do is find the best cold readers and really study their answers and see if their claim about cold reading really holds up. Now, there's one other thing to interject about the cold reading claim, the cold reading hypothesis, as it's usually given, and that's that the explanation has to be explicit. Now, I've gotten into it. So you skeptics, you're not allowed just to throw the cold reading blanket on there and say, oh, maybe they can do it with cold reading techniques. You should really be able to explicitly say, as you've done, as the good cold readers in our experiment have done, you need to say, this is how this led to this. If you leave it open, if you leave it my gut feel, if you leave it my instinct, any of that stuff, then you're not doing cold reading and you're entering into the realm of anomalous cognition that can't be explained. So let's make that clear. Cold readers have to be able to explain how they do it if their claim is to have merit. Now, this change in how we view cold reading doesn't result in any huge differences in the experiment, but it does have some in the way we'll set it up and do it in the future. And particularly, it's going to have some impact in how we analyze the results. So if my big takeaway number one is that there's definitely something going on, and number two is the experiment is doable but tricky in some subtle ways, then my final big takeaway is that this is a pretty big effort, and the sooner I move it into the hands of university researchers, the better, because it's taken way too much of my time. And not that I regret being as hands-on as I have been, because it's really given me a unique vantage point and a clear sense of how to do this and how to fund this research in the future. But it's definitely time to get some more researchers involved, and that's what we're going to do. And that's also an open invite. If any of you are interested in receiving some funding to take on this research, email me. I've already had several researchers who are in the queue on that, but I'd love to have more of you to consider, and I will definitely keep all of you updated as we go forward in selecting and funding people to do this. And that doesn't mean that I'm done doing it either. I'm going to be going forward as well, but I really want to make it a priority to move this research to the next level, because it's ready. I've learned a lot, and I have to kind of move on and do some other things. Okay, so with those three points out of the way, that's enough about the big picture. Let's talk about trial three and why I reshuffled the deck in the middle of the trial. First, the numbers. We had 40 cold readers go through the trial. None of them got all four correct. Then I had four of our best, at least best based on the two previous trials, go through the trial, and none of them got all four right either. You hear the disappointment in my voice? I was disappointed. I really was. And that's when I jumped in and called a temporary stop to things. And for the last few weeks, I've been scrambling around trying to figure some things out. Because pretty quickly, in looking at the numbers, I realized that there was a lot going on. There's a lot of interesting backstories from the little bit of data we got from our mediums and from the larger amount of data we got from our cold readers. And let me give you some of those backstories. First, not only did none of the cold readers get all answers correct, they really didn't even come up with much cold reading stuff. And that's good. I mean, that's progress in terms of it shows that we were able to learn from our mistakes, if you will, in the first two trials and realize how to tighten up some of the information that we gave and made it harder for cold readers to kind of do their things. And as a matter of fact, we've even since then come up with some more ways, and all that will just make it better and better. So cold readers didn't really come up with much, with one small exception, and that's kind of a story in and of itself. A couple of cold readers looked at the first reading for Athena trying to connect with Elizabeth and said, bam, that's got to be the professional medium because only a medium would name their kid Athena. Well, they were right in that Elizabeth was the medium and Athena was the daughter. But it turns out they were a very strong Greek family, and the naming of their daughter, Athena, had more to do with their ancestry, and that being a very, very Greek name, than anything else. So that's really more of a lucky guess than anything else, but nonetheless, it's an interesting connection. And there's also a connection between this reading, Athena trying to connect with Elizabeth, and the other backstory that I wanted to tell you about. And it has to do with the quality of some of the readings that I did get through. I just mentioned earlier that none of the four mediums that we tested on trial three got all four of them right. Nonetheless, some of the readings that they gave were amazingly accurate. And I wanted to share one of those readings with you to give you a feel for what kind of readings we've been getting in these experiments, and also to kind of highlight a point that I've often thought about but never had an opportunity to talk about, and that is sitting from my vantage point and running this experiment with skeptics or cold readers on one hand and mediums on the other, as soon as you start doing that, you immediately realize how completely different the process is for the two groups. Now, skeptics naturally assume that mediums are doing the same thing that they're doing, that they're doing this cold reading stuff. And as soon as you get into this, you realize they're doing anything but that, just the opposite of that. They want less information, not more. They want to totally engage their right brain and totally shut off their left brain. And they complain whenever they have to use logic and deduction. And that's been somewhat of a problem with the experiment. For example, having to type while you do a reading is difficult for some people. So anyways, just as someone who's been involved in this experiment, I just can't stress that enough. It comes through so clearly that the way these people are getting this information is so completely different than what you would normally think if you assume they're doing cold reading. That said, I know that doesn't matter to a lot of you and you really need to see the results. I want to see the results too, but I can't ignore the fact that that's just painfully obvious as soon as you get in, you work with these people. So as a small way of demonstrating that, let me give you an example of one of the readings that we got for Athena trying to connect with Elizabeth, and you can kind of look how different this is than a cold reading process. Here goes. I am the psychic, she says very clearly. I had a hard time figuring out who this was, so I just asked her to come through and then I'd know. And that's the first thing she says. She's a very proud woman, almost regal in the way she holds herself, her posture. She says something about her cat, White. She's with her husband. She says his poor heart misses me. She says, I finally have my son back. He's with me now, better than ever. I see a room in their house that's very rich in color, decorated in reds and golds, very warm, curtains that filter the light, candles. It was her special place, and that's where her husband goes now to feel her. They have kept this room the same for her loved ones to spend time in. She had a special drink that she always drank. It's sweet and fruity, not sure if it's wine or not. She's also referring to my books. She says they have to be read. She says I was right about so many things, but there's so much more to it than you know on your plane. She's very happy and at peace and highly progressed on the other side. She says she is around you often and guides and protects you, but everything is still your choice. She says that my cause of death was that it was my time, time for me to fly and move on. Take care of yourselves. I love you, and I'll be waiting for you. Now, some of you who are more skeptical might view that reading as just the usual kind of mumbo-jumbo tarot card fluff stuff. But there's a couple of points in there that are just amazingly accurate, and we actually went back and confirmed them with the sitter. One small point is the point about the room and the fact that the husband never lets anyone go in the room, won't sleep in the room, no one is allowed in the room except to go and talk to his deceased wife. That wasn't in the description. It comes through in the reading. The second thing that is completely non-existent in the description but comes through in the reading is confirmed by Athena is this issue of the books. And there were these books, and they're discovering her books, and they found all these journals and these books that you've written, and they're even trying to get them published. So this was something that was very important to her. No one knew about, we didn't know about in the initial description, but it's something that turns out to be very important to the family, very important to the sitter. So the fact that this reading was such a hit is an interesting backstory to the little bit of data that we have, but it also points out some of the problems. Number one is, in the descriptions that we've been giving, we provide so much information that it makes it hard to understand whether the medium is coming through with any new information or is just somehow echoing back the information we've given in the description. So that's something we want to change going forward, because one of the things I've come to see is that the readings are important. And even if they present some problems in statistically measuring their accuracy, I think we want to create an experiment that allows the readings to come through unencumbered by a lot of detailed descriptions. And that's also something that our mediums are asking for again and again and again is, why so much description? Isn't that really my job? So as I look at the clock here on my recording, I see that I'm already well past 15 minutes. And since I am less than halfway through describing all the changes that we are implementing with the new experiment, I think I better cut this off here and leave room for my very interesting interview with Dr. Alan Wallace on Buddhism and atheism, somewhat of a follow-up to the last episode of Skeptico when that topic came up. So I'll certainly have much more to say about the medium experiment in the upcoming episodes of Skeptico, and stay with us for that. In the meantime, stick around for a great interview with Dr. Alan Wallace. As many of you will recall, the last episode of Skeptico featured an interview with Denise O'Leary, one of the co-authors of the book, The Spiritual Brain. And in the course of that interview, we meandered into a subject that stirred up a bit of a controversy among you, our listeners, and that's the issue of Buddhism and atheism. Well, as a way of kind of following up on that, I'm very pleased to welcome back to Skeptico Dr. Alan Wallace, one of the foremost scholars and lecturers on Tibetan Buddhism in the West, and an author of many books on the topic. If you go on Amazon and Google Alan Wallace, you'll find Contemplative Science, Embracing the Mind, The Attention Revolution, Genuine Happiness, with a preface by the Dalai Lama, and many, many other books. So, Dr. Wallace, thank you for joining us, and welcome back to Skeptico.
My pleasure to join you once again.
As I said, this is really a response to something that came up last episode, and there's so many things that I'd love to talk to you about, and time permitting, we'll get to all of that. But let's jump right into this first issue. Obviously, in the last 10 years, there's been this resurgence of atheism, and some would say angry atheists, like Richard Dawkins, Daniel Dennett, Christopher Hitchens' best-selling New York Times bestseller books, and they've popularized this position that belief in God is anti-science and just plain dumb. And whatever you think about that position, that is what this new atheism is all about. And I think where I'm coming at this is when we encounter Buddhism, you know, despite its popularization in recent years, it's still a little foreign and strange to a lot of people in the West. And out of this soup of Western culture that we all kind of mix together, we have this idea that maybe Buddhism is somehow atheistic. We might have heard about that. So let me boil it down to a simple question. Is the Dalai Lama an atheist?
This question is almost like, why do you beat your wife?
Right.
in the framing itself, the question is already skewed. It's not so obvious to a person who's totally immersed in Western civilization and has almost no glimmering of understanding of anything outside of Western civilization. And frankly, so much of the rhetoric, this anti-religious rhetoric from the likes of Richard Dawkins and so forth, is just wildly, unconsciously, and uncritically ethnocentric. Underlying these critiques, and it's quite homogenous, Daniel Dennett's no better, is the frankly uncritical and uninformed classification of Buddhism as a religion. That is, it looks like a religion, it smells like a religion, it looks a lot like Christianity, there's prayer and so forth, therefore it must be a religion. What is ethnocentric about this is the very categories of religion, including as well as philosophy, science, these are Western constructs born out of Euro-American civilization. We take them uncritically as if these are somehow referring to real absolute entities, and we've simply discovered the definitions of these categories, and then just blandly, casually, in most cavalier fashion, superimpose them on traditions of inquiry and so forth that are outside of the Western European or Euro-American nexus. And so this is just illegitimate. Just as illegitimate as asking flat-footedly whether the Dalai Lama is an atheist. So this type of question, and of course I'm not criticizing you at all, it's a perfectly legitimate question within an absolutely ethnocentric framework. It really calls for a deepening of one's own framework and a critical reflective attitude about the nature of the question itself and the, how do you say, the constructs that we bring to it. Number one, Buddhism is not simply religion as defined by the Abrahamic religions of Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, so we better take a fresh look. And within the Buddhist community, this is the question that's virtually never posed by people like Dennett and Dawkins and so forth and so on. Do Buddhists themselves ever ask themselves, is our tradition a religion? Well, no, they don't, because they don't have a word that corresponds to our Western term of religion. Do the Buddhists themselves, and I'm honing in on your question, do the Buddhists themselves ask, are we atheists? Well, I've never seen that question both in Buddhism. It would be regarded as such a dumb and uninformed question that it's not even worthy of a response. Now, is your question worthy of response? The answer is definitely yes. It's coming out of a Western context. But now the first question is not an answer to that question, but a question. To the question, and that is when you ask, is the Dalai Lama an atheist? Exactly what do you mean by a theist or an atheist? So let's start with an atheist, obviously, is a person who is not a theist. So who is a theist, and which means what do you mean by God? And so if by this term God, we're referring to the God of Abraham, who's male, who created the universe, who governs the universe, punishes the disobedient and rewards the obedient, that's who God is. And God created the universe ex nihilo, and he's looking after you in response to your prayers, and is omnipotent and omnipresent and omnibenevolent. Do Buddhists believe in such a God? No. I don't think any Buddhists believe in that God, at least none that I've ever met, and the Dalai Lama doesn't either. And so if that is what you're defining as God, then the Dalai Lama is an atheist. With the Dalai Lama, does he walk around thinking, I'm an atheist? I very much doubt it. It's an absurd category because this whole Abrahamic notion, a rather crude and primitive one, as I've expressed it, bearing in mind there are much more subtle notions of the deity within Christianity, this is simply not an issue that even comes up in Buddhism. So does Buddhism characterize itself as atheistic? The answer is definitely not. Is the Dalai Lama in Buddhism atheistic with respect to that definition of God, which many Christians and Jews embrace, then the answer is yes.
Let me reflect back to you. A couple of things that you brought up to me in the email exchange that we had that really struck me as getting to the heart of this. The first is that you suggested that this kind of dialogue of lumping or trying to categorize Buddhism as atheistic is uninformed. And here's the part I like, quasi-truth that creates confusion and alienation. And I'd like you to hone in on the confusion and alienation. And then I'd also like you to kind of reflect on the essay that you sent me that I guess is a part of is published in your book. So, this is your point here. Some take this position that Buddhism is atheism to show the inferiority of Buddhism over their own creed. Others do it as a means of demonstrating Buddhism's superiority over other religions. But on the whole, most people categorize Buddhism in this way because it's the conventional position to take, and they never think to question it. Would you like to add anything to that?
Well, it's, again, what I'm critiquing here is the unreflective, unself-critical use of the terms as if we've simply, you know, taken the categories of atheism and theism, plucked them out of reality, and then asking whether, you know, how Buddhism stands up to that without recognizing that these, both of these categories, atheism and theism, are deeply embedded within our own Euro-American culture. Deeply embedded within, specifically within Abrahamic religions. And so when scientific materialists, who some of whom are sympathetic to Buddhism, they like to present Buddhism as being atheistic because it shows that Buddhism is not as delusional as religions they regard as being completely wacko. But then they want to kind of subsume Buddhism into their own materialistic framework, very eager to do so, right, which is just an utter violation and evisceration of Buddhism.
Right.
Now, Christians, there are some, and of course there are all kinds of Christians, some very sympathetic to Buddhism, open-minded, and others not so open-minded or sympathetic. But I've read this repeatedly in print. Christians, sometimes Jews, certainly Muslims, like to depict Buddhism as atheistic, but as if they have the franchise on determining and defining what is God.
Right.
Well, if they, you know, and in which case, who gave them that right? Did God give them that right? If they believe so, then all very well. But, you know, this is rather, again, simply naively ethnocentric and unworthy of cross-cultural discussion.
You know, I think that's really interesting, and I would add a little personal anecdote. I'm not a Buddhist, but I've been inspired and influenced by some thinkers of that tradition. And, you know, in particular, I remember back going through a phase when I was really quite a bit angry about my Christian upbringing, something that a lot of people go through. And I remember reading the book Living Buddha, Living Christ by the Vietnamese Zen master Thich Nhat Hanh. And I thought that book was a real opening for me because what he did, and he comes from a different Buddhist tradition than that you most know about, the Tibetan tradition.
Quite so.
But
quite so, yeah.
He shows in a deeper way how these traditions might be linked at a deeper level that we don't appreciate unless we start pulling things apart and both pulling them apart and then putting them back together. So pulling apart the ethnocentric or the cultural aspects to it, but then also looking deeper and exploring what might be the underlying spiritual dimension to these traditions. So any thoughts on that, and in particular, how different Buddhist traditions, and there are many different viewpoints, as I understand it, within each tradition, and how all those come to bear on kind of untangling this mess.
Indeed, yeah. It's a very rich question. And I agree with you. This book by Thich Nhat Hanh is a marvelous read. There's a somewhat similar and also very, very thought-provoking book by the Dalai Lama called The Good Heart, his dialogues with a marvelous Benedictine monk named Father Lawrence Freeman on the interface between Christianity and Buddhism. And for what it's worth, within less than 2 weeks, my latest book will be published called Mind in the Balance, Meditation in Science, Buddhism, and Christianity. There's a lot of Christianity in it, and I'm treating Christianity with great sympathy, and I hope some insight. I've looking into currents of meditative practice and theory that have run through the Christian tradition from earliest times right to the times of the Desert Fathers, the medieval era, right up to the time of the Renaissance, and somewhat right into the present day, and showing, I think, very significant parallels in the kind of methods that are used of contemplative inquiry and the type of insights that are gleaned from such meditative practices, and drawing parallels between these type of practices and theories with Buddhism, which then raises the whole issue or allows us to take a fresh look, I think, at the very notion of divinity within Christianity, that it's not all that kind of caricature that I presented earlier. But from a contemplative perspective, they're much, much deeper, more nuanced, and I think profoundly experiential notions of the divine, which actually have very strong parallels, remarkable parallels, with some of the deepest contemplative insights within Buddhism. Now, obviously, this is something for each reader to judge for him or herself, but I've done my best to draw some meaningful parallels and acknowledging the differences and also pointing out some of the, I believe, meaningful parallels within, in modern science that may point to the same reality. And so I think that would be kind of a basic stance, is to look more carefully at the different notions of the transcendent within the Western traditions, the Abrahamic traditions, as well as various forms of Eastern spirituality, not only the many schools of Buddhism, but also Taoism, Confucianism, bring some nuance to it. And then, as you say, break them apart and then put them back together so that we can approach all of these traditions in a sympathetic way, a charitable way, seeking as much understanding from them as possible and not as little as possible.
That's wonderful. And, you know, one other point I wanted to approach this from, and it came up in my discussion with Denise O'Leary and the Spiritual Brain, and I kind of drew out the difference in how I see Christianity, and again, those terms fail us when we talk about Christians and Buddhists, and of course, it's just not a homogeneous group, but I really appreciate the Dalai Lama's position on the relationship between science and new discoveries, particularly in consciousness research, and how that would affect his faith, his religion, and that the way I read that, and I want you to kind of steer me and tell me if I'm wrong here, but that he is open to whatever discoveries come about because he is about seeking the truth, and therefore science is his ally in kind of understanding the truth. And what I tried to, what I really called upon Denise to do, or what I lamented, is that more Christians don't seem to take this perspective, and they seem to take a defensive perspective vis-a-vis science and say, science, you can't prove anything that I believe wrong. And it just seems that when you turn the equation around, like my understanding of the way that the Dalai Lama has, is say, no, you don't have to prove anything. That it's not about proving me wrong. It's about, let's go arm in arm together and try and discover this mystery and try and unravel it and try and discover the truth. And that'll really get us all to where we want to be. Any thoughts on that?
Sure. As you can imagine, I have quite a few. I think the place I want to start is a fundamental distinction between Christianity as it has evolved, especially over the last 1500 years, and Buddhism. And that is in Christianity, salvation is a gift of God, whether you're a Roman Catholic, whether you're a Protestant. Salvation is a gift, and one receives the gift by way of faith, by way of belief, by way of obedience, but not by way of knowledge. And so in the Jewish tradition, we go back there, we'll see that God rewards his children who are obedient, but punishes those who are disobedient. The very notion of Islam is one of submitting to God's will, and those who submit to God's will, follow God's will, then open for themselves the path to salvation. So it's really all about faith, belief, and obedience. And then worship, of course, and good deeds, but primarily the preceding. In Buddhism, the path to liberation, the means to liberation is above all, and it's very explicit in Buddhism, it's knowledge. It's knowing reality as it is, and not simply philosophical knowledge or inferential or conceptual knowledge, but direct empirical knowledge through immediate experience. This is what liberates. And what we are liberated from are the tendencies of ignorance and delusion, as well as derivative mental imbalances and afflictions such as craving and hostility. And so science is foremost and above all a tradition of knowledge. Now, it comes with assumptions, it comes with cultural mores, theological influences, philosophical biases, all kinds of things. But above all, what makes science science is that it's a method of inquiry and the discoveries made by using the myriad methods of inquiry of the scientific community. So in this regard, it would appear that science and Buddhism would be natural allies. That is, both of all place the highest priority, not on obedience or conformity or faith or simple belief or submission, but rather knowledge. And so in this regard, yes, the Buddha does want to join arm in arm with the scientific community, recognizing there are complementary strengths to scientific and Buddhist, especially Buddhist contemplative and philosophical inquiry. The great strengths of science being the use of technology to observe and to investigate objective, physical, quantifiable phenomena. And that includes individuals' subjective reports, their verbal reports of their mental states, their behavior, brain states themselves, environmental, physical influences on the brain and on behavior on the mind, Western science, I'm referring now especially to the cognitive sciences, is very strong in this regard. Buddhism doesn't have the technology, the MRI, the EEG, and many, many other kind of behavioral methods or the statistical modes of analysis and so forth. And so this is a great strength of the Western tradition. But when it comes above all to the study of the mind, which is utterly central to Buddhism and didn't even enter into scientific inquiry until the late 19th century, when it comes to the study of the mind, the great strength of Buddhism is the direct observation and penetrating investigation of the mind from a first-person perspective, which, after all, is the only way that we have any direct way of measuring any mental phenomenon at all. And so in this way, there's a complementarity. Now, the Dalai Lama has repeatedly stated, and I know he completely means it, that if the scientific community shows compelling empirical evidence to repudiate any Buddhist claim, including some of the core claims, even of reincarnation and so forth, or the nature of the mind, then Buddhism will go along Buddhism will follow the truth, will follow the evidence. What Buddhism will not follow are simply the metaphysical assumptions that saturate so much of the mind sciences, which in fact are hardly ever called into question, and for which there are virtually no methods for even repudiating or putting these assumptions to the test. To give a couple of examples, all mental states and processes, all states of consciousness, are generated solely by the brain in relationship with the body, the physical environment, and the social environment. That is an assumption that's virtually never questioned in the scientific community, and yet it's never put to the test, and there's virtually no discussion about whether it's even true. It's never been validated, but it's not hardly even being tested. Another statement, all mental states and processes, all states of consciousness are themselves biological processes within the brain. That may be true, but nobody's ever demonstrated it. And in fact, the relationships between the subjective experience and their neural correlates remains a mysterious one. Right. No one has ever demonstrated that it is a correlation of equivalence. A third and final one is that at death, at brain death in particular, all mental states, processes, states of consciousness vanish because they're simply emergent properties or functions of the brain. That's an assumption that never gets tested. It's never even called into question, and it's never been validated. Buddhism is not going to go along, at least Buddhists like the Dalai Lama, are certainly not going to go along with metaphysical assumptions that saturate scientific inquiry, often presented as scientific truths without any empirical evidence, and that are never even put to the test. For Buddhists like the Dalai Lama to accept that, we would simply have to be naive, gullible, and have a lemming mentality that goes along with the herd without ever questioning the direction the herd's going in.
Right. Well, and I think the trend line on the cutting edge of consciousness research is really pointing in a direction that is very complementary to the Buddhist perspective on that, and we'll see how it all pans out. I just think that is the way, in my view, to kind of bridge this false dichotomy of science versus religion. And I know religion is a fuzzy word to attach to Buddhism, but still, the way to kind of overcome that false dichotomy is to join arms and say, we all just want the truth. Let's figure out the best tools and means to get there. And I think that's exactly what you said. You know, let me switch in the final topic that I wanted to talk about today. I want to touch on meditation, and you talk about contemplative science and first person observations of the mind. And I think you're talking about, in simple terms, meditation. And for many of us in the West, that's still almost a caricature, if you will, of Buddhism, is this connection with meditation. And in our forum, in the Skeptical Forum, we've had some very interesting discussions about meditation, some people who are wondering how to get started in meditation, or are just curious or not so curious and don't think it's such a great thing. And I just want to point people to, and I thought you could take a minute to talk about your podcast series on meditation. I think it's outstanding. And from someone who has to really work at their meditative practice like I do, and that's why I'm still on your first or your second series, which I've listened to probably 100 times, you know, the same one over and over again. But tell us a little bit about, if you would, your podcast series and meditation from a Western perspective, if you will, because I think that's what really, to me, came through and came alive in the meditation series that you offer. And I've, like I said, I've listened to many, many, and read many, many books over the years, and I really found yours especially good for me, I guess is the only way I can say it.
Let's look briefly at this word meditation, which once again we need to bear in mind is an English word, not a Sanskrit or Tibetan word. And the English word meditation traces back to the Latin root, which means to measure. And so meditation, I'm going to come back to Buddhism, but actually even though this is a Western etymology, it's actually quite useful even in the Buddhist context. And that is, if we're, insofar as we're interested in understanding subjective experience, our immediate experience of the body, immediate experience of the environment, and then above all, our own minds, there is no technology devised yet that can directly measure any type of subjective experience at all. Directly observe, directly detect, and not even physical pain, and very well-trained physicians know this well. They know about neural circuitry and so forth, parts of the brain, nerve endings, and all of that, but it is not a one-to-one correlation to pain. And even if it were a one-to-one correlation, simply finding the neurocorrelates of pain does not imply that the neurocorrelates themselves are pain. And so if one is really interested in understanding mental phenomena, then, like any other branch of science, the primary mode of inquiry, according to Buddhism and according to Galileo for the entire physical universe, is observe it carefully and directly. And this is what a major feature of meditation, to observe carefully, rigorously, critically, one's own state, mental processes and states and so forth, not only simply to understand them, which is crucial, but understand them in order to learn how to heal the mind of its afflictive tendencies and bring forth from the mind its own inner resources of qualities that are conducive to our own and others' well-being, qualities of mindfulness, of equanimity, of attentional skills, of generosity, and so forth. And so this podcast series is I think made available over the Santa Barbara Institute for Conscious Studies, of which I'm the director. The website SB, as in Santa Barbara, sbinstitute.com. And so there's a whole series there. And the idea, the central theme here is to make these available to people, whether they're Buddhist or not Buddhist, with no sense of trying to convert anybody to a worldview, but simply make available a matrix of, I believe, very rich, provocative, and insightful methods of first-person contemplative inquiry that can be used by anyone. I'm hoping in the process of this that the Christians themselves, the Christian community, will rediscover their own immensely rich heritage, which has been largely obscured over the last few centuries by various factors I won't go into right now. But I'd love to see something of a contemplative renaissance taking place within the Jewish tradition, the Christian, the Muslim, and so forth, so that we can, when religious people come together, we're not limited to talking about or debating our metaphysical beliefs. And likewise, in religious and science conferences, meetings, encounters, we're not simply squaring off and with the religious people trying to defend their beliefs while the scientists are defending their beliefs in the midst of also presenting empirical data, but in fact that the contemplatives from various religious traditions, and Buddhists, that we can all shelve for the time being our metaphysical assumptions, both materialistic as well as theistic, as well as non-theistic, shelve for the time being even assumptions about reincarnation, karma, and so forth. Shelving doesn't mean to dismiss or repudiate or even marginalize. It just means let's set them aside and focus on the experience. And so in so doing and proposing this, I'm really following the strategy of William James, who's one of my heroes, in his promotion of what he called radical empiricism. Right. And that is to come right back to immediate experience itself, take it seriously, wherever it leads us, and not shunt off or marginalize types of experiences that do not correspond to or somehow maybe call into question some of our most deeply cherished assumptions, whether they're Christian, Buddhist, or materialistic. Let's get back to experience.
Great. You know, I think there couldn't be a better way to end it. And I thank you again for your time. And hopefully this will generate some more interesting discussion. And of course, there's always more in your books. And I also would encourage people to visit, is it sbinstitute.com?
.com, that's right. Right.
Well, Dr. Wallace, thanks again for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thanks again to Dr. Alan Wallace for joining us today on Skeptico. If you'd like more information about Dr. Wallace, including a link to his new book, Mind in the Balance, visit the Skeptico website at skeptiko.com. Also invite you to take part in our Skeptico forum, which has quite a lively discussion on these topics. Also, at our website, you'll find a link to all our previous shows, an email link from me where you can drop me a note. That's going to do it for today. Until next time, Bye for now.